Good evening and welcome to this Friday's edition of Stockwatch. I'm Zinati Guma, and joining me to wrap this week up are independent analyst Chris Gilmore and Rikus Reuters from PSG Wealth Sandton. Thank you to the both of you for joining us. Let's get into it. I won't be starting with macro today. We're just getting right into the thick of things. A viewer's asking, panel's view on Sea Harvest and Signia. Let's start off with Sea Harvest. So it came out with an update recently that it's completed the acquisition of MG Kaelus, that is the Australian fishing business. I feel like I'm expected to know this, but why, why is it that, you know, what's the deal with the fishing environment in South Africa? Because Sea Harvest says that they want to reduce their exposure to the local fishing grounds. Chris?
Yeah, look, fishing is a volatile industry. It's a, what's it called? It's a biological asset. And, you know, it comes and it goes, and you've got quotas, and it's very difficult, you know, to try and keep tabs on this one. I mean, we only really get much of an insight into it via AVI and Irvin and Johnson, I&J. And it's done reasonably well in recent years, but secular decline, basically. And it's difficult to get awfully enthusiastic about it because of the volatility. Look, make no mistake, it's a vitally important resource. Mm. But, you know, there are better things to be invested in. And frankly, I find the volatility to be something that I don't enjoy in Sea Harvest or in I&J.
My thing, why the specific, why are they saying that they want to move away, or not really move away, but they want less exposure in the South African fishing grounds and they want to go to Australia? Is it not the same across the board?
Well, the main thing is politics. There's been argy-bargy about quotas, as Chris mentioned, local quotas. And, you know, if your policy doesn't agree with your business model, then you move your business somewhere else, which is what I think they are doing. But more broadly speaking, I agree with Chris. You know, if it's a biological asset that moves the whole time. So 1 year you go where the fish is, and the next year you don't. And in the meantime, you've got to have your trawler steaming across the ocean with high fuel prices. So it's a bit like farming. In other words, you'll have good years and you'll have bad years, and there's no real predictability to it. So I tend to avoid that as well.
Okay, so you're not into any of the fishy counters as well. All right, let's go into Signia. So what's the panel's view on Signia? I'm sticking with you, Rikus. Yesterday, Anthony Clark wrote in the Financial Mail, the counter is the Marmite of asset management. You either like the company, its championing of the low-cost model and its dynamic, outspoken founder, or it's simply not to your palate. Do you like Marmite, or is it not your thing, Rikus?
Oh, you're right. I suppose there is that personality risk associated with the company, but let's face it, they've been very successful, at least innovative, when they started off. But in the end, they are a fund manager. They make their money out of the spread between what they offer, the buying and selling price, first of all, of the ETFs, and then obviously also a certain degree of annuity income if you do an off-market investment with them, if I can call it that. Mm. So in that sense, I think to a certain extent, the share price will be driven by the activity in the market, first of all, and then, of course, also by the uptake in their funds. And you can only diversify so much. But in that sense, I think they are broadly comparable with any other type of asset manager.
Mm. Chris, do you think the same, that they're comparable to the other asset managers? And also, how do you feel about investing in asset managers at this time when the market isn't hot, where they have these bleak outlooks, concerning the operating environment?
Yeah, you know, I listened to a chappie called Kyle Hewlett, who is one of the main people at Signia, and he has been absolutely spot on for the past couple of years. He's a bright young lad, and he and his team really do their homework. So I've got a lot of time for Signia, certainly in terms of their asset allocation. The fact that they tend to concentrate more on passive management is interesting, and less on active management. Going back to the days of Roland Rousseau, people like that pointed, you know, he pointed out quite conclusively that trying to beat the market actively is a bit of an exercise in futility, because and that's why the passive industry has been such a roaring success in the US, particularly over the past decade and a half or thereabouts, even longer. And Signia, I think, has been joining in that movement, because, as I say, most of their funds are passive, and they've done extraordinarily well. And they offer a remarkable range within that broad universe. So, look, I would slightly disagree with Rikus. I mean, sure, they're fund managers, and it's going to be tough for all fund managers, but I think they do differentiate themselves in that regard by having more of an approach towards passive than active.
Right, point taken there. Question, could the panel explain the Quilter share consolidation process as well as the prospects for the company in the present macro environment? Rikus?
Okay, I can't remember the precise detail, but basically, Quilter got rid of a secondary, I think, B class of shares, and what happened was that you got you got one share for every six, no, for every seven. In other words, if you had seven shares, you've now got six shares, which basically is, which pushed that should push the market price up a little bit. So it's just a share consolidation, and you also got a capital repayment reflecting the one share that you lost. So it's a bookkeeping exercise. It didn't really affect the value of Quilter. Talking about active and passive management, Quilter is an active manager and good track record. So in that sense, bound by the market. And as Chris quite correctly pointed out, it's far different from your passive type of strategy that has suited Signia so well.
All right. There's another question. Which three SA stocks are screaming buys? Okay, we'll approach it this way. Chris, you pick three stocks, and then Rikus, you pick sectors. All right, so Chris, go on with your three stocks that are screaming buys.
And they're going to be actual SA stocks, is that right?
Yes.
Well, okay.
I mean,
So I've got.
listen, it doesn't have to be three also. If you're struggling with three, it's fine.
Okay. Well, you know, I've got a good old favorite here in City Lodge. I think Aframat is also a screaming buy. And strangely enough, and I've mentioned it on this show before, I think Absa is a screaming buy for a variety of reasons. And not the least of which is they got a new CEO, which I think is going to lift them out of the mire that they found themselves in over the past decade and a half. And I think they're going to start taking market share away from a lot of the other competitors. I think, you know, my views on City Lodge are fairly straightforward and well known. At some point in time, this stock, I think people are going to realize that people are going to come back, and they're already coming back, and the occupancies are moving up. And this is, to me, as far as my opinion, it's a screaming buy. Aframat, you know, the iron ore price, if you draw a graph, you know, if you take the average of a moving average of the actual iron ore price over the past year and a half, 2 years, although it's a lot lower than it was, say, back in 18 months ago, it's still a lot higher than it was a few years ago. So it's costing them 35 to 40, maybe $50 a ton to mine it, and they're getting around about $120 a ton. To me, it's an absolute no-brainer. Incredibly well-managed company. So those would be my three.
All right, EPSA, City Lodge, and Afrimat. Rikus, on your side, sectors, you also don't have to get to three. Sectors that are screaming by.
It ties in perfectly with what Chris has just picked as his three stocks. In South Africa, we're very good at lending each other money and buying goods. In other words, selling each other consumer goods. And thirdly, this country is still an export, you know, is basically a resource-driven country. So in that sense, in the shorter term, definitely the financial sector, considering the increase in interest rate, right? So I think the retail sector has pulled back nicely, and there's probably some bargains to be, not bargains, but at least decent levels to be looking at the likes of, you know, something like Pepkor, which has just had very nice results, Spa, which is maybe a recovery story, and then the resource sector. You know, some of the platinum stocks are down about 30% from their highs. The mining houses are looking interesting, but that's also dependent on the global economy and specifically what's going to happen in China going forward. But I think those are the three areas that I'd be looking at.
Let's carry on with the questions from the viewers. What's the panel's view on ArcelorMittal? I mean, this counter has really had a dramatic change in its fortunes. The company in February releasing record earnings last seen in 2008. Rikus, are you bullish or bearish on the stock?
Dependent on the iron ore price, they'll make profit and they'll not make profits. Their plants are old and decrepit. If I want to go into a steel maker, I'll go offshore.
Straightforward. Chris, you look at that share price, it did fall a bit recently because of that recent strike, but it surged significantly in the last year or so, but also because it came from a low base, so it's considered cheap. Do you think the company is in good shape for you to take a bite in, or is there still a lot of work to do before you're convinced, like Rikus?
I agree entirely with what Rikus has said. No, I don't like this thing. I think it really is decrepit. And an awful lot of money has to be spent on their plant. And I just made reference to the iron ore price, which I think is probably going to keep on creeping up, which is bad for ArcelorMittal. So on those grounds, I would say no. I don't think that's looking very attractive in the slightest.
All right, let's go into hospital stocks. They actually had results out this week. So there's a question here. How bullish or bearish is the panel on hospital stocks? So we had Life Healthcare yesterday coming in with a profit decline, but going back to dividend territory. Actually, all of them are in dividend territory. Mediclinic revenue ahead of pre-pandemic times, but earnings still slightly below pre-COVID. Steady improvement in Netcare's financial performance. Rikus, hospital stocks?
Look, it's been a recovery play from COVID. The healthcare sector is not a bad place to be in if you're going into a slowing global growth environment. So all three of those have their merits. I think the big bugbear is what's going to happen locally as far as national health is concerned and regulation. Specifically South Africa, but also more globally. You know, governments don't like their voters getting sick, and they will always have a regulation to try and play to the voter, to the detriment of whomever provides the service. But certainly, I still think there is room for improvement for those local stocks. I'm mildly optimistic about the sector.
Okay, mildly optimistic about hospitals. Chris, on your side?
You know, if you put all of the things that Rikus has talked about into the mix, yes, you should be mildly optimistic. And yet, you know, actions speak louder than words. If you look at what the government has done to these companies over the years, I mean, first of all, you weren't allowed to expand effectively. You had to kind of make do with what you had. Then they changed their view on that. they are at the mercy of regulation. And the worst thing, of course, is if you get NHI. Well, I shouldn't say if. When NHI comes in whatever form, it's going to be bad for the certainly for the private industry. And I think it's going to be an unmitigated disaster, frankly. So I think if it gets caught up in that, it could be really, really problematic.
All right. Talking about problematic, rising costs are really proving to be very, very problematic for food producers. We had Tiger Brands and Rhodes Food coming out with results this week, really just talking about the pressure that they are experiencing with those high input costs. Rikus, would you be going into food stocks or food producers at this point?
You know, I think maybe farmers and the guys that deal with it will disagree with me, but in the short term, yeah, we have a food crisis, but it's not like oil, for example, where you really are stuck with where the oil comes from. In other words, so there is the problem in Ukraine. We are seeing food inflation right across the globe as there's problems in logistics. But these things tend to solve themselves as, you know, other regions take over from regions where production was lost. The logistics problem will sort itself out at some stage. So there is a short-term pain, and maybe those food stocks aren't looking that attractive in the short term as a result. But if we then go and look at the specific two companies you mentioned, I think Rhodes Food is a very well-run operation. And that might be something to, I won't say bottom pick, but at least as a recovery play, look interesting. And Tiger Brands had, I think, better results than expected, and there might be a recovery bounce in it. But then what? You're still holding Tiger Brands as an investment, and I think there's a lot to be done to change management in that company. So in short, I think food producers will bottom out at some stage. I'm not going to try and pick the bottom. I'd rather wait for a recovery to happen. But quality-wise, then you've got to concentrate on quality, and Tiger Brands is not that for me yet.
Chris, food producers, and would you rather go for food retailers if you're not that optimistic about the producers?
Zanati, you must be a mind reader. that's precisely what I was going to say. If you look at the results of the food companies, the food producers and the food retailers, you can see that just in terms of revenue growth and turnover growth, the food retailers have done markedly better in the past couple of years, even with, and I would say, arguably the best run food company out there is AVI. Even AVI is struggling to get into low single digit revenue growth. So I agree with Rikus. Rhodes Food is a great company, although it's never really produced the potential that we think is there. Tiger is my least favorite consumer stock ever. And I have got no time for it, frankly. It's ever since Nick Dennis relinquished control of that one, it's gone through so many disasters. He was a super manager, but since then it's been rubbish. Look, there are one or two others. Libstar, I think, is a reasonable operation. One or two others. But yeah, AVI, Libstar, and that's really about it.
All right, so those are the producers that you'd be going into. There's a question here. Any comments on Richemont? Any expectations to reach, say, 250 in the short term? Rikus?
Probably not. I think it's back to sort of more reasonable levels. It obviously depends on China in the short term, but I think at 250 it was far too rich. At current levels, hopefully it will consolidate some. But you know, if we see further scares on inflation, further talk about global economic growth slowing down into a recession, we might see it trading lower. But I think longer term, I'll be quite happy to hold it if you can suffer another 15-20% drawdown.
Right, yeah, they did release that bleak outlook on China. Chris, if it does continue to go further down, would that be an opportunity for a buy?
Look, I think so. And Rikus is spot on. I mean, China is pivotal in all of this. And as long as China persists with its slavish adherence to a zero COVID policy, it's going to be problematic. I think the moment China wakes up and realizes that you cannot contain a virus, and realize they have to live with the virus, then I think the outlook for so many stocks, including Richemont, is going to become enormously brighter. But this can go on for a while yet. I mean, they are, as I say, they've got the slavish adherence to the zero COVID policy, and that combined with the higher inflation, disrupted supply lines, is going to put the brakes on the global economy. But the moment you get a move away from that zero COVID situation, then I think it could change quite rapidly.
All right. There's a question here. Panel's thoughts on Mr. Price. It did, of course, release that trading update yesterday, flagging a profit. Rikus, how are you feeling about Mr. Price? Really seeming that they are really benefiting from their acquisition strategy.
Yeah, again, as I mentioned at the start of the program, it looks like South Africans, one thing they're very good at is selling stuff to each other, and Mr. Price is excellent in that regard. Mm. The low end of the market, which they, to a certain extent, dominate, will, you know, necessary clothing, whether it be for yourself or for your kids or whatever, it's almost a forced purchase. So in that sense, I'm sort of neutral on them at the moment. So I think longer term, probably not a bad level to be in them, but I don't really expect fireworks, you know, over the short term.
Okay, so no fireworks for you. Chris, it's quite interesting, actually, that these fashion retailers have broadened into the home space. We see Mr. Price, of course, it has Mr. Price Home, and then it has Yuppie Chef, and then you see TFG also going into that home space. So where would you rather be there, Chris?
Well, I think it's a tough one you asked me, because I like both of them. Mm-hmm. And I think that in the longer term, it is those two that are going to not just survive but flourish in the longer term. And I think you'll see many others fall by the wayside. The nice thing about TFG is it's got its own in-house manufacturing capability, helped by generous donations from government, and it's doing surprisingly well. So TFG, I think, has really taken the whole market by surprise. As Rika says, Mr. Price is exquisitely positioned at the low end of the market. And I think as we go into 2023 and we see even lower economic growth, they'll be very even better positioned. Let's not forget that as interest rates rise, and they are, it's in a rising trend, then retail sales growth across the board has tend to come down. So in that regard, you've got to go for the guys who've got good balance sheets, like Mr. Price, like TFG, and who can still extract some top-line growth from it. And so the two of them, I find it difficult to choose. TFG probably, I think, has the edge.
All right. On to your stock picks. Rikus, who do you think has the edge tonight?
Well, again, in this volatile market, I'm hesitant to go for a certain stock pick because who knows what's going to happen. Chris mentioned China's COVID policy. I mean, they can't change it because that will mean two things. They admit that their policy is wrong, which the government won't do. And secondly, they'll have to admit that their vaccine medicine is not as good as the West's. Mm. So happen that to continue. So in that line, I also then expect your energy problems to continue. And for the longer term, it's an investment company called GRID, or Gresham House Energy Fund. Basically, what they do is invest in battery storage, specifically in the UK, but now also looking to branch out. I think it's a long-term, it's not a specific company. In other words, they invest in other companies that do this kind of thing or have it on. And I think for the longer term, as the world has learned, it's absolutely essential to have something like that online in case of an emergency.
All right, Chris, your stock pick for today? We don't have a lot of time.
Okay, I'm going for something completely politically incorrect. It is called iShares Aeronautics and U.S. Aeronautics and Defense ETF. Basically invests in about 30-odd defense companies. And rather than going for single stocks like Lockheed Martin and Northrop Grumman, I think this offers you a bit of diversification. And if you believe that the war in Ukraine and elsewhere, after Putin has finished in Ukraine, is going to carry on, which I do, I think this is going to go on for 3 years, then I think defense stocks are probably one of the places to be.
All right. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for your time and your insights this evening. That's it for Stockwatch this week. Thanks to my guests, independent analyst Chris Gilmore and Rikus Riedes from PSG Wealth Sandton. From me, Zinati Kuma, and the rest of the team, have a great weekend.